Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome today here with...
Where?
Who's on?
Am I on?
There you are.
Okay, there I am. I'm still Leah Gilmore.
I hope so. Center for Emerging Media's cultural correspondent, and of course, co-host here once a month, and wonderful human being, singer extraordinaire.
Yeah, a lot of lives there.
We'll talk about all these lives. And I want to, before we jump in here, let me just tell you all this, because this is very important to the future of our program. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, MeQ is a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you. For more information, www.mecu.com, or go to steinershow.org and click on their banner. It's always better. This is Mark talking now. It's always better to go local. Put your money in local.
There you go. I agree.
Yeah.
I'm not just going to disagree to disagree. I'm going to agree with you. Okay?
You wouldn't just disagree, but we do disagree sometimes.
Oh, yes, we do. And we still love each other.
Yes, we do.
There you go.
410-319-8888. You can join this love fest anytime you want at 410-319-8888.
Oh, this crazy fest.
So first, we got to talk about, we always begin this way. You just came back from Siberia.
I know. It's almost like...
A month.
It's been about a month that I just came back from Siberia. And I was just asked to come back in June.
It's a little warmer in June.
They promised me, right? They said, Leah, it's going to be warm, like 65 degrees. I thought, wow, it's kind of cool. But all, just very honestly, it may have been one of the most amazing cultural experiences. I mean, I think even more than doing the concerts and the lectures, just my being there in Siberia was a thing, because there were no people of color. And literally, when I walked up the street, people would stop. I went to a ballet.
No black folks.
No
in
black
the,
folks
in like Siberia.
No, but no black folks with this kind of rear end at all. So I went to a ballet, because that's what you do when you're in Russia, you know. And I was the focus. You know, it was really interesting. Women would run up and want to take photos with me, because it was like, is it okay? Is it okay? The translator would say, they just want to, you know, be in a photo with you. I mean, very respectful. Awesome. I was treated awesomely, treated interestingly by the security, you know, and treated awesomely by the people. So it was such a great experience. And I think I represented Baltimore very well. I talked about being from Baltimore a lot.
Did you perform while you were there?
I did perform while I was there. You have not lived till you've heard, 500 Russians sing Wade in the Water with me.
Oh, wow.
So it was great. And we talked about, just peace, nonviolence issues, equality issues. It was really magical.
You do that wherever you go. You do these concerts across Europe, across here, in Zaire, mm-hmm. wherever you go. And you always bring up the social and political end of the world.
Oh, yeah.
That's part of what you do wherever you go.
Oh, yeah, because, I can sneak it in there. I've been so blessed. I've spent so much of my time, so much of my professional life as a social advocate and a nonprofit director, and then so much of my other life as a singer. And somehow, the universe has found a way to mesh the two. So when I get the opportunity... people will listen to you more when you sing it than when you say it.
That's true.
So I'm going to sing the rest of this the whole time now, okay?
Right? For the rest of the show? No, good. When the other people come on, you can...
I'll just say, how are you? Mark Steiner, the opera.
I love it. You should do that.
Hey, there was Jerry Springer, the opera. In the UK.
I thought you mean Mark Steiner the Opera as a show.
Yeah.
I got you.
You're not following me.
No, I got it.
These ideas are exceptionally innovative, Mark. Come on now, work with me.
I got it. And this Friday night you're going to be singing.
I am so excited, because I so rarely get the opportunity to sing in Baltimore. I sing all over the world almost, and... for good causes. And I said, again, I'm blessed. And this is a part of the Common Ground on the Hill Music and Art Series. And I am the third concert in the series tomorrow night, Friday night. And guess who's going to introduce me?
Who's that?
There's this dude on the radio, Mr. Mark Steiner. He's going to be in the house.
I can't wait.
It's going to be some great stuff. I mean, the legendary Phil Wiggins, I mean, who is one of the most amazing blues harpists, is going to be with me. And oh my God, Delegate Mary Washington
is going to sing with you.
Is going to make her singing debut with me.
Wow.
All right. And this is Friday night at the Brown Memorial Woodbrook Presbyterian Church. They have a great performance space, 6200 North Charles Street.
Oh, it's on that. It's up there.
Yeah, because I went to the other one.
Oh,
where Andrew is.
I'm glad you said, because otherwise I'd have been at the wrong church.
Yeah, I did go there.
Where you were.
Me and my girlfriend Shelly went, and we were like, wait, it's dark. You know, when we went to see Guy Davis. But no, it's the side that's right up here near us on North Charles Street. Again, Brown Memorial, Woodbrook Presbyterian.
I guess it's going to be a good night.
It's going to be a good night.
So y'all got to join us, and we'll tell you more about that during the coming week and on promos and everything else, so you can be there with us on Friday night with Leah Gilmore.
Yeah, hanging out. I'm going to try, honey.
It's going to be good. So, folks, join us here at 410-319-8888 in about 10 minutes or so. I think we're going to call out some folks who have been involved with Oakland and D.C. Occupy.
Right.
And what's going on with them. We're going to be talking a little later in the program with Sujatha Fernandez, who has a book called Close to the Edge in Search of the Global Hip-Hop Generation, and plays some hip-hop from very political and radical hip-hop from Senegal, from Tunisia, and from Egypt. But we've been following these races for president.
Yes, yes, we have.
There's a contest on the Republican side. And I really want to get your thoughts right now, folks. 410-319-8888, as I sit here with Leah Gilmore. Newt Gingrich, to start with.
To start with me, you throw it to me, and I'm just going to wax eloquently right now.
Well, I could wax, together. You know?
Well, but, you know, I think this is a bigger, what's happening now is there is a general frustration amongst a certain population of people that Newt Gingrich represents, you know. And I heard, for instance, I heard on an interview with a young woman, an older woman from South Carolina, who said, oh, I don't care about all that stuff with his wives and nothing. I just want him to get that Obama out the office, you know. And so they felt he's strong and he's this leader that's going to get Obama out the office, not realizing if you just step back a second, this was a man who was literally put out of Congress. I mean, and he's saying, I am not the Washington establishment. He prided himself on knowing Washington better than anyone else. He's also, I mean, if you look, he has voted progressively quite often on several issues and has partnered with many people who a lot of his future constituency would freak out and have a heart attack about.
Well, I mean, one of the things that hits me about this and about this particular race is I think that Newt Gingrich was probably the man who invented the divisive politics in Washington,
D.C. I agree with you.
Teaching other people how to not talk about issues, but to attack.
Right.
Attack people personally.
Right. Contract with America.
And he has kind of that kind of politics has taken over the land. And not that people shouldn't have great debate and fervor on the sides of what they believe, but he's taken it to the lowest level possible.
Right. And what that means then is that, you know, you can't counter it with flowers and honey. What happened is that all of the politicians have to come on to attack and, you know, use these super PACs instead of their own, you know, themselves to create the most hateful commercials, which are very personally destructive. And this is what we call politics now. This is what we want to be, whom we want to be our president. I mean, we just saw
President Newt Gingrich.
Don't say it. Okay, let's take a second. Okay, it's out of my head. All right. But it's interesting because, you know, Mitt Romney lost in South Carolina. There were a lot of virulent attacks on him. And he said, well, I'm going to do the same thing. You know, when he turned around and went to Florida. Florida is an extremely important state, you know, and the Republicans don't want it to go blue again, as they say. You know, they are still quite agitated by losing Florida during the last election. So Romney has taken this significant lead, and Newt was pretty much, they were neck and neck. But Romney has put on some pretty intense commercials down there. But there's this group of Floridians who just says Romney is too rich to understand them. They say he just doesn't get it, and because he said something about Newt Gingrich not being able to talk to the regular man, and one of the guys said, "Well, Mitt is a regular man," you know. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of divisiveness within the Republican Party. I think that they really don't know what they want. They just don't want Obama. And that's it.
And we have a very divided country. And what's happening here, right. I think, when you see Newt Gingrich use phrases like, let me look these things up, because it was amazing what he did. He did this in the past. He's doing it again. And he likes to degrade people behind him. Mm-hmm. He told people to use words like festering, decay, and sick about people he doesn't agree with. And it really is like a McCarthyistic kind of viewpoint in America, and what he's pushing, and it's and people say he's very bright, and I think he's probably one of the brightest men running for president of the United States.
I don't disagree with that, and that's what makes it scary when you put bright with insidiousness. You know, when you put those two together, you know, you get a bomb. And I think he really scored a lot of points when he sparred with the African-American journalist. You know, we're really dealing with a lot of uncomfortable race issues involved in this campaign, with Newt representing one side. And I think he speaks for a lot of these people who are quite angry at the situation that we're in now, you know. And let's face it, some of these people just don't want a black president. When they are saying anyone but Barack, it is so much more than just about his policies, you know. We can definitely talk about his policies. We don't agree with all of them. We don't disagree with all of them. But there are other issues going on here as well. And to deny that is to deny the truth.
I agree. What do you think out there? 410-319-8888. Like your thoughts here. Leah Gilmore here on the Mark Steiner Show today, as we kind of explore many different kinds of topics. 410-319-8888. We're going to talk to some of the folks in Occupy. Some violence is going on in Oakland and Washington, D.C., maybe putting people out of the parks. And we would just want to hear your thoughts on where we are here right now. I think that we're in a weird place, because I think nobody has the answers. Nobody can. Nobody knows. Barack Obama's not doing it, and the Republicans certainly don't have an answer.
We're not asking the right questions. You know, a lot of times the things that we think Barack Obama can do, Congress can do, but they put themselves in the position while they are campaigning, to say, I'm going to make this change, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, knowing that it is definitely a system where, you know, some of it's Congress, some of it's the Supreme Court, you know.
I think that sometimes, though, we are in a place where we can no longer answer the questions, the issues it faces, because I'm not sure that this present system, A, the present capitalist system, and B, the present system of corporate power in government and the influence of money in government, will allow it to happen. And we're thinking about, just looking here in Maryland right now, you've got the governor proposing that the counties in the city pay 80% of the teachers' pensions. Take that back. Well, they can't afford it, and the state can't afford it. At the same time, they're telling the counties, you have to cough up the money to pay for education, and it's your responsibility. And seven counties are meeting, including Montgomery and Wacomico and Worcester and some other counties, because the way the system is presently structured, they can't figure out how to get the money. So teachers are going to get paid, schools are going to lose money, and I don't think we have the wherewithal to get it done.
Or the political, we don't have the people with the political, I'm trying to find the euphemism that's at the tip of my tongue, I'm trying not to use, with the strength, the political strength to do what really needs to be done and to tell the truth, you know. In a country where Mitt Romney pays 15% taxes and a teacher may pay 35% taxes, there is something wrong there. There is something. I mean, the wealthiest Warren Buffett, the wealthiest man in this country, in the world, maybe one of the wealthiest in the world, says this is a ridiculous tax system.
I will say it was slick of Obama to have on Warren Buffett's secretary. Let's hear what.
Do you know? Hey, do you know Warren Buffett's like really good friends with Jay-Z? Just wanted to say that.
410-319-8888. Andrea, you're on the air.
Hi, Andrea.
Hi. How are you two doing?
I'm doing great, Andrea.
Welcome.
Well, I'm just going to say, please repeat everything you guys said again so everybody can listen. Because I was so mad at that old lady on Friday. Oh, my God.
Did you hear her?
Yes, I heard her.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
What old lady on Friday?
Saying this, but I was like, okay, I'm going to take your black card.
Right.
I was just like, she was such an embarrassment. And I know I don't normally do race. I really don't. But mm-hmm. I was just like, you know, it just sounded like that whole hatred. And like, just like you guys said, our country... Ever since he got elected into office, I mean, I guess maybe those feelings had never really died down, but now everyone's so vocal, and it's like, wow, this stuff really hadn't gone away. So I just want you guys to repeat it again so people can get it in their head.
Well, you can always listen to the podcast, young lady.
Yeah, like, he is not the Messiah. He's a president. And just like you say, those systems, these old, tired systems, mm-hmm. you know, we're kind of stuck with them. And there's not, you know, he can't wave a magic wand and say, oh, okay, we got employment fixed. I feel like he really is doing the best. I don't agree with everything he's done. I can't say that I agree 100%. But let's say I'm about 85% satisfied. You know?
Yeah, and I think you made a very good point, Andrea, because he is the president of the entire United States. And he is, by default, the leader of the free world, because we're still the strongest country out there. And I know that by traveling as well. And the European system right now is really suffering, really struggling with the euro. And I think that I feel the same way. It's always so uncomfortable to talk about race and its influence. But we know this is a very real thing that that we do have to deal with. I don't agree with everything he does. And I don't think there will ever be a president that I'll agree with everything he does. But there's something fundamentally that I do agree with you, Mark, broken in our system.
Yeah.
You know,
and
that whomever inherits it is going to have to deal with it. Until we get political bravery, until we find someone who truly has political bravery and is not worried about their next election and gets real fundamental change, we will stay like this, and we will have so many Arab Springs, American Springs, UK Springs, because people are frustrated and they're tired.
Well, it's a perfect lead-in to people who have just been called out to. And we're going to get, and we'll introduce them, but let's get our next caller on as we introduce them. For the next little bit, we're joined here by Omar Yassin. Omar is an Occupy Oakland participant.
Right.
He blogs at hyphenatedrepublic.wordpress.com. Dr. Margaret Flowers, organizer of Occupy DC, congressional fellow from the Physicians for National Health Program, and Eric Lotke, who is also part of Occupy DC, but he's also a senior policy analyst with the Service Employees International Union.
Wonderful.
And welcome, Omar, Margaret, and Eric. Good to have the three of you on with us.
Welcome.
Thank you for having us on.
Welcome, Margaret.
Hi, and it's great to hear you.
It's wonderful to hear you. And Margaret's a fantastic musician, by the way.
I know. I've seen her play
okay.
and heard her sing. But let me ask a question across the glass. There's line two. Is that a caller? Can we go to the... Yes, no, yes. Let's go to it. I don't have a name on my screen, but whoever they are, put them up, and I'll see who they are.
Hello, welcome.
Is this me? Or
Hi, yes.
It is
Hi.
You. And who are you?
I'm Omar. I don't know whether you're talking about me or...
Oh, Omar Yassin, one of our guests. Welcome.
Oh,
good to have you.
Hi, Omar. Welcome.
Hi.
So, I see. That's the same, you know, callers. The callers were there, but they seem to disappear. They'll come back at 410-319-8888. Omar, you've been holding on for a while. You heard some of our callers.
Me? I've I have a little work to do, so I was using that time to do that work. But I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, Omar, I'm very interested about what happened this weekend. I mean, because we're getting such different stories. Each side seems to have such the definitive truth on what happened. And it was, I think, over 400 people were arrested.
We're talking about Oakland, California.
Yeah, and what happened out in Oakland. So I would love to hear from your perspective what was happening.
Well, I'll start at the beginning. You can hear me okay, right?
Yes, we can.
Okay. We had, for the past month and a half, planned an action to take over a very large building that had been abandoned and wasn't being used for the people of our city of Oakland. We invited all kinds of members of the community. We had a great rally. We were going to have a two-day festival in front of that building as we occupied it. It was a symbolic occupation to show that not only at the national level, but at the local and state level, there's just a tremendous misuse of resources, and all these resources not being used for the good of the people of the 99%, even though our tax dollars and our efforts have created them. So this building had not been used in nearly a decade. It's just sitting there. It's the Kaiser Auditorium. Up until the point where we went there, we had kept it a secret to avoid a large police response, and that's very important to note, that we did not want to have clashes with the police. We were having a peaceful march to the destination, and we were hoping the police wouldn't work it out on the way where we were headed, because we know the Oakland Police Department has a lot of problems with discipline. They're at the door of federal receivership. They're just about to be taken into federal receivership. There's been about $58 million in lawsuits over the past 10 years paid out because of their abuses of citizens of our city. When we got there, they had figured it out. They stopped us from going, and they began to kettle us. At that point, there's some back and forth. I didn't see myself anything being thrown at the police officers, and I have not been informed of any real injuries to police officers, but they claim that they were attacked. But at this point, I think it's really important to note, no matter what happened, the police responded in a way that violates their own policies from the beginning. And I saw this myself. I met a young man last night who was shot in the face with a projectile called less than lethal ammunition, either rubber bullets or beanbags. You're supposed to aim these at people's feet or closer to their torso, but they were standing up and shooting right into the crowd at face level. He was hit in the face. This guy I met last night was hit in the face. They were pointing it like in my direction. This is at the point where I started, ducking. They hit a lot of people with rubber bullets. Then they sprayed tear gas. And this is a community. This was like right in front of the Oakland Museum. And there's a transit station right next to it as well. And people who weren't involved in this were getting to their destinations in downtown Oakland. That violates all of their policies. Everything that they did is a violation of their policies. They're not supposed to shoot indiscriminately into the crowd. They're not supposed to use tear gas in this method.
Right. So, but Omar, just a question before we ask Margaret and Eric to join from Occupy DC. What was the objective of your action? I mean, what were you going to do with this site once you took it?
Well, we were going to do the same thing that we had done in our occupation in front of City Hall. What we had created in front of City Hall was a community of self-organizing people from the community. It was born, it included everyone who wanted to be a part of it. No one was kept out. So specifically in our occupation, maybe unlike some of the other occupations, homeless people, the poor, the formerly criminal element, people who didn't want to be involved in necessarily in dealing drugs or doing other things because of the lack of work, everyone was invited, and we created a very special community there that obviously had a few problems because of how difficult it is to do that kind of thing, but also created a really important political space where new ideas about how to move forward were being brought up. And I think it's important to note that the Occupy movement came out because we've lost faith in the electoral process. We've lost faith in the elected leaders to change anything. They're corrupt. They're captured by the 1%. And this was the start of a movement for people to say, well, we're not going to engage in your process anymore because it's already bought out. We're going to form a parallel process. And then you leaders can jump in here. You can join us. And that was what we were going to do. We did that in front of City Hall before we were suppressed by the police. And we were going to go do it again in this building.
So let me turn to Eric and Margaret in D.C. for a minute. And And I understand, but one logistically, I want to ask you a question, Mark, and then go to Eric. They were going to move, Park Police were going to move out the occupiers in D.C. from both sites today. That didn't happen, did it?
It hasn't happened yet, Mark. Basically, what they did was they delivered notices saying that there's no camping allowed in the federal parks. And so far, we were down at Occupy Freedom Plaza, which goes by, is under Occupy Washington, D.C. They were complying with the park police in terms of having their tents open so the police could see inside, and using the tents as more of a meditation space instead of a sleeping space. So we haven't yet seen the police take action. There was a lot of activity in D.C. today with people who came out, with press who came out, and we suspect that if there is action taken, the police will wait until there's not so much attention on them.
All right. Do you think they're going to try to do the middle of the night thing again?
Well, that's a definite possibility. Mm-hmm. That's been the pattern that we've seen around the country.
Right.
They do that when, and we've also seen a pattern of keeping the media out so they can't see what's actually going on.
And I'm curious, again, let me turn to Eric Lucky, who joins us, who's part of Occupy DC, and he's also a senior policy analyst with the Service Employees International Union.
But I'm speaking as an occupier, not for the union. And I am agreeing with Margaret. The police order was that starting at noon, we will enforce the rules against sleeping in the park. Well, that's not a showdown at noon. People were not sleeping at noon today. And so there is a great concern that they will come in the middle of the night without the press and without the crowd. And they'll start arresting, you know, and if people are sleeping in their tents, they'll start pulling them out one by one by one, not 200 people of SWAT teams in a giant open confrontation at noontime on K Street. That's not what a lot of people were expecting. And so individually, people are figuring out how they want to handle that. And then the background question for the movement, which is more important than anything, and the micro tactics of the D.C. police and what people are doing tonight at midnight, the big question is, how does the movement go on? What is the next phase? What are the post-physical presences?
Right.
What unites Occupy DC and Oakland and Boston and all the rest of it? And all of these people who are fed up with what's going on and want to change the economy and want to change the political system, and these occupations are one expression of it, and what happens tomorrow and the day after and the day after is the big question for the
All right.
That was actually my question, Eric. We've got the Occupy movements happening all over the country. And what is going to come out of this? I mean, are there discussions being had where these Occupy movements will gather strength in numbers and become one national entity of some type to challenge the things that a lot of us are unhappy about?
I like to think so. The Twitter feeds are full. The web pages are full. Mm-hmm. There's all kinds of email traffic between InterOccupy, I think it's interoccupy.com or something like that. There's a National General Assembly webpage. There's lots of InterOccupy communication going on, asking exactly these questions. What is the next phase? Occupy our homes with the foreclosure resistance. You know, how do we keep a camp at all, or you know, somewhere somehow? Or really, we need to move beyond that. What is the electoral strategy? There's a lot of occupiers who say, we want to take back the House in November. We need an electoral strategy. This is a campaign season, and you can't get away from that. And there's other occupiers who are saying, I'm sick to death of the electoral politics. It's broken. We all mobilized for Barack Obama. Where did that get us? And the whole thing is broken. Don't vote. Now, I like to think that the go vote will win, and that the people who've lost patience just haven't worked hard enough to, you know, for enough years. And so, you know, I'm in the Take Back the House camp, and I really like to think, and where I see it going, is that the occupation movement is not going to go away, and it's going to strengthen, it's going to go dig deeper in communities.
Okay.
Occupying
if I can respond.
It's going to go nationally with the electoral, in the electoral season.
And Mark, go ahead, then I want to hear from Omar, and then we'll take a break and come back.
I think Margaret wanted to speak.
Yeah.
I think one of the clarion calls of the Occupy movement is that it's not about who is in a position of political power at this point. It's the fact that the system is broken. And at this point, with corporate rule, it doesn't matter who we put into that position. And so really, we see this as a long-term struggle, and that initially our goal is not an electoral or a legislative one, because both of those are dead ends at this road. We've got to build this movement, educate ourselves, move into our local communities to do action. actions that work outside of the corporate system, building local economies, taking back homes, democratizing the economy through cooperatives. This is the year of the cooperative, building sustainable food networks, and really working at that level to weaken the current system so that it can be, at some point, the power can be shifted away from corporations and we can have effective public policies that reflect both the will and the interest of the people in this country. So we hope that this year during the electoral season that people recognize that the conversation going on amongst the candidates is a false conversation based on what their corporate funders will allow them to say, and the real conversation is happening in the Occupy movement about what the true issues are in our country and the evidence-based solutions that we have to every crisis that we face.
I hope you can hear me because I wanted to stay right on to everything she just said.
That was Eric.
I'm very happy and grateful for that friendly amendment. Thank you, Margaret.
Thank you.
Very well said, Margaret.
Go ahead, Leah.
I think that one of the key points that Margaret said is that this is not a short-term movement. I think that we are so used to instant everything here, like in 3 years a president is going to change the world. That's not going to happen. I think we recognize that with a broken system, it takes a while for it to get fixed. And, you know, with that comes a lot of dedication and unfortunately some of the things that happened in Oakland and in other places as well. But is there's Margaret, Eric, and Omar, beyond the social media, is there an attempt, and Eric, you answered this a little bit, to really organize this movement and say, okay, now we know that there are people who are very unhappy and want the change. We're going to organize and we're going to maybe get brick and mortar place that we're going to exist, you know, or is that becoming too much like the system?
I think there are definite efforts to sort out the next steps and find ways to work together. Occupy Wall Street has some excellent working groups that are up and running. The Inter-Occupy mechanism is a tool that occupiers are using to connect and organize actions and to discuss issues. There's an Occupy Solidarity Social Forum happening next month in Olympia, Washington. We're organizing for a spring action in Washington, D.C. called Now D.C., the National Occupation of Washington, D.C., which will involve both education and direct action. And then there's movement into other areas. There's talk about a work stoppage on May Day, moving to Chicago for the G8 NATO gathering in Philadelphia in July. So things are kind of really, we're hoping that they'll snowball and pick up momentum as the year goes on. There's a lot happening.
I think that's right. And it's also, it's going micro and it's going local as well.
Right.
Community gardens and people talking with homeless people and people talking at risk of foreclosure and figuring out what can be done, what the people with the occupiers and their energy and their ability to network can do, networking locally can do with these individuals with their problems. And what comes out of it in the short term is cleaning up a playground, and what comes out of it as a long term is community building and this reinvention of our political system.
No, that was Eric, right? So Omar, we haven't heard from you in a minute.
Yeah, well, I mean, I really like a lot of what I'm hearing, and I'm sorry I forgot the young lady's name.
Margaret.
Margaret
Flowers.
I hope so. I'm both on the phone. But whoever was talking about this being an extra electoral conversation, we are not talking about creating energy and then throwing it away back into the electoral process as we've been doing for over 10 years and seeing no gains. I think even like institutional organizations like big unions are tired of doing it. So what we're doing is like creating a conversation, creating a movement, and it's almost like kind of like, you know, having a main circle of fire and everyone puts their torch in the fire. That fire is always going to be there, even if the torches go out. We've been approached by unemployed steelworkers who were unfairly thrown out of their jobs, and they want our help in organizing a demonstration against that. We were approached by some workers at a licorice factory in another city who wanted help with their picket against a really strong foe that was using a strike-breaking company called Huffmaster. We went out there and helped them. And think this is the sort of future of what we can do. We're here as a resource for everyone who is struggling against this 1% government cooperative organization to use the power of Occupy and to, you know, start getting these things done with popular power, not electoral power.
So let me open the phones here. 410-319-8888. Our listeners think in the next 10 minutes or so we have in this segment. Some questions will come to mind when I hear this. And one is, I mean, I heard definitely clearly some differences Eric and Margaret were talking about earlier between whether or not you want to have go vote or no vote.
Right.
Which is, I think, a big difference in terms of where energy should be in the year 2012 and why. And B, one of the questions that has come up on this program a number of times when we talk about this is that, you know, people calling for national demonstrations, going to Washington, D.C. And the question is that a lot of this seems to me to be, let me take that back, that this may be not having the effect desired on regular working people in America, because how is this touching their lives? I mean, I've asked many Occupy people who are occupying centers of cities, occupying downtown Washington, well, why aren't you occupying abandoned houses and working with poor people to take over houses and seize those as people's homes? Or taking over, but where?
Here, in Oakland.
What?
Forgive me if I answer like an Occupy.
Well, one at a time. Omar, go ahead.
Great idea. Go do that.
Let me just finish. We do a lot of different things. I mean, the amazing thing about Occupy Oakland is it has a GA, the General Assembly. That's our official actions. But within Occupy Oakland, the people like me, like other people who are involved in these official actions, like the building takeover, we are also involved in things like foreclosure defense. There are people taking over these houses all over Oakland. We had a very big foreclosure defense a month and a half ago. We took over two homes that where families had been kicked out because of foreclosure. We got one family back in the house, and they're still there. And in the other house, we took it over to show that these houses aren't being used for the 99%. They're being used to enrich people. I mean, and it's unfortunate that, I mean, our intentions are really good. I mean, we are regular, normal people. We are working people. We are the same people you're talking about, and these are our communities. But I think people who are dishonest, who work for the city, and people in the media who regurgitate whatever they tell them are painting a picture of us that's really not accurate. And I wish people would investigate the facts before they make these assumptions.
And where can they go investigate the facts?
I would certainly recommend OccupyWashingtonDC.org. Our website is updated regularly with articles and videos. But I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead, Omar.
But that's what I was going to say, too. Our website is also, it's updated every, like, 2 hours, and we have all this information on there. I blog at Hyphenated Republic. I've talked about all these things. There's lots of writers who are associated with, and tweeters who are associated with the Occupy Oakland movement. There's no shortage of information from people involved in this movement. I think people would rather get it from a secondhand source. I don't know why.
Great, and we can put those websites on
our website.
Exactly.
Great, thank you.
Right.
We'll definitely do
that. So people can, it's better have it everywhere.
Right.
That's right.
And I guess, and some people, there are different sides of this argument, and Eric, what you were saying a moment ago about go vote, no vote, I mean, I think that is that's a very serious discussion to have in terms of what people should be doing in this year 2012.
Right. And, it is, no matter how you slice it, it's an electoral season, so this is going to happen. And what is it doing for working people? You know, on the one hand, nothing yet. On the other hand, it takes a while for things to change. And I feel like the political dynamic, thinking politically for a moment, the political tone is changing. It used to be all about deficits, nobody talking jobs.
Right.
And now people are talking about jobs. And I feel like in the State of the Union speech last week, Barack Obama was talking about the banks. And it was a real people versus the powerful kind of a speech that he could have given last year, and he didn't. And I feel like it's the occupation and what it has unleashed in the spirit of the country that Obama was addressing again.
Yeah, I think this is one of the difficult tasks ahead for everybody, is to figure out what form all of this takes.
Right.
And Mark, what you were saying earlier, and there have been discussions whether a massive march in D.C. is what people need, or people need to be by the thousands in their own communities doing things.
Well, I think it's both, Mark. It's really both. I mean, the position that we're in right now took 40 years to get here. It really can be looked back to the Powell memo that was written by Lewis Powell before he became a Supreme Court justice in 1971, wrote a memo to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which outlined the path to where we are now, calling for more lobbyists, for think tanks like the Cato Institute and Heritage Foundation, corporatizing our education process. So we need to see this as a long-term effort, and we're just not going to get change in this electoral year. It really doesn't matter at this point what President Obama is saying. We have a corporate-controlled government, and the policies are not going to change. Now, the Occupy movement is affecting the rhetoric, and that's great, but whether we actually see a shift in policy is doubtful. So the Occupy movement has, you know, has to recognize that we have a certain finite amount of resources, and how do we best employ those resources at this moment? And I think that that it's movement building, it's education, it's at the local level, doing these things to meet our immediate human needs, like keeping families in their homes, like forming worker-owned cooperatives, like forming local economic institutions, democratized economic institutions, these sustainable food networks. And these are the things that we can do right now, which will both meet our needs and weaken the corporate structure.
We have to take a break here. And I first want to thank, you just heard Margaret Flowers, who is a congressional fellow with from Physicians for a National Health Program, part of Occupy DC. Eric Lotke, also part of Occupy DC, his other part of his life. He's senior policy analyst at the SEIU, and he's speaking not for that this hour. Omar Yassin is participates in the Oklahoma. Oklahoma.
Quite different.
Well, you could go to Oklahoma, man. I don't know.
Quite different.
In Oklahoma at the moment. Oakland Occupy and blogs at hyphenatedrepublic.wordpress.com. And thank you all three for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mark and Leah. It was great to talk to you.
Always.
Bye. We're going to have a brief break and come back. When we come back, we're going to be joined by Sujatha Fernandez to talk about how hip-hop is the voice of revolution around the world and what that means. On the way there, let me remind you, support for WEAA is made possible by The Book Thing, 3001 Vineyard Lane in Baltimore. The Book Thing accepts donated books and dispenses them at no charge. The Book Thing has over 200,000 books in stock and gives away almost 20,000 books each week. Open Saturday and Sunday from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. For more information, bookthing.org or 410-662-5631. Leah Gilmore and Mark Steiner will be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner.
And I'm Leah Gilmore.
And we're here for another part of the Mark Steiner Show. Leah and I are. And before we jump into that, I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Mortgage Program, a community lending initiative of the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. The number is 1-800-638-7781. If you are first or second time home buyer in Baltimore, they have many houses available to you. The Maryland Mortgage Program, 1-800-638-7781.
Good stuff there.
It is good stuff. I read an article this morning in the New York Times, and it really hit me because we've been doing a number of radio programs on the power, the cultural, political power of hip-hop across the globe and in America. Mm-hmm. And there's a mixtape project being pushed here in Baltimore by Dr. Lester Spence from Johns Hopkins, where he is working to create a hip-hop movement of young people in Baltimore to take on the social issues, the building of the juvenile prison here in Baltimore, to oppose
right.
that and many other things.
And it's actually quite active.
Very active.
Yeah.
And so they, and it's part, and last week we did a program on the hip-hop world and the Arab world with Palestinian rappers and with American rappers and with some others in our studio, Dr. Jared Ball and others, to kind of keep examining the power of this new culture, which we'll be doing with Dr. Lester Spence a great deal. This morning I read this piece in the New York Times by Sujatha Fernandez, who is author of a new book, which we're looking forward to reading and getting, Close to the Edge, In Search of the Global Hip-Hop Generation. And she's associate professor of sociology at Queens College and the Graduate Central City University of New York. She was, if I understand, a hip-hop artist in Australia.
Oh, herself. In Australia?
I believe that's correct. We'll find out if I'm wrong. And Sujatha, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Hello.
Hi, Sujatha.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Sujatha. This is Leah Gilmore.
Mark Steiner.
Hi. Nice to meet you.
So was I right about that?
Yes. Well, many years ago when I was very young and I became involved back in the early 90s with the hip-hop movement in Australia, which was how I first came to be involved. And, I was part of a rap group there at a time when there was an important anti-racism movement going on, and that's really how I came to make those connections between politics and music that have stuck with me ever since.
That's really it's really interesting how far, Sujatha. This is Leah speaking. Hip hop comes from the
Doesn't
same
sound like Mark.
Roots. It could be. I could pretend I'm you. It comes from the same roots as the blues. So much of the African American Indigenous music was about protest and about telling our stories, from spirituals to field hollers to blues to gospel to hip hop. And I really like the title of your book, Close to the Edge, because I'm kind of a member of one of that first wave of hip hop, and it reminds me of the message. And I just wanted to know, is that where you got your title from?
It is.
That's right.
Because I was sitting in Maroubra, which is this neighborhood that I was growing up in mm-hmm. Sydney, and I was watching TV late night, and I see the message, and I was so struck by it. And it was something that, to me, I couldn't really explain because I didn't live in a ghetto. I mean, I lived in a working-class neighborhood that mm-hmm. was still quite far from a ghetto and far from the experiences being described in the song. And so, it really always struck me, why did the song appeal to me so much? And it was partly this search across different countries and many years to try and understand why not just me, but so many people.
So many.
That this culture right. appealed to them. And there is something about anger in that song that I think really did and continues to have a very strong
right.
appeal.
And the word, don't push me because I'm close to the edge.
Yeah.
I'm trying not to lose my head. It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under.
Uh-huh.
And I think that is not something that is just indicative, as Sujatha has said, of just being an American young teenager like I was. But
when that came out.
When that came out, I was
right,
a young teen.
Right.
And hip hop for me and for a lot of the young teens was Public Enemy and Wu-Tang Clan and all these people before it was corporatized and taken over to be
thuggery.
Because this is not how hip hop started.
Misogynist thuggery.
Extremely misogynist thuggery, because it was not about that. It was about protest and messages. And it's wonderful that she uses the message as the title. So congratulations on that.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. So we talked about this a bit last week on the air, it was a really interesting discussion about why hip hop has taken hold across the globe as the universal voice of protest and in the streets and of revolution, where the cultures in the nations where it's taking place have kind of consumed hip hop and been consumed by it at the same time.
Right.
And I'm curious why you think, what the dynamic is that's going on throughout the globe with that.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the interesting things is that hip hop has managed to maintain this political edge for so many years. And as you mm-hmm. said, here in the U.S. it's been corporatized, and in many places that has happened. Many of the places that I've lived and worked, one example being Australia, where I saw a very vibrant movement in the early years of the 80s and 90s turn into something that was very much taken over by the music industry and sapped of its political content and social commentary.
Right.
And so even though that has happened in waves and in cycles, it nevertheless has this potential to suddenly erupt with a political message and to erupt as a beacon for political movements like, you know, like we've seen in the Arab world, like we're seeing in Africa, like we're seeing in Latin America. In so many places, it retains that potential. And I think part of it has to do with the fact of its origins, of where it came from and how it was a voice here for African-American youth. And I think that really means something. And the rappers around the world who I work with and speak to constantly say that, how important that is to them, the fact of where it came from and how it did give a means of expression for marginalized youth. And
right.
I think, you know, exactly. Today they're still listening to American rappers like Immortal Technique, who you had on the show, and,
right.
and others who have that political message and who really, their message appeals to people very broadly.
It's amazing how it has just permeated the world. Also France and the Netherlands and in the UK, and it's these communities of color have taken hip hop on for themselves. And they, you know, they talk about the American artist, how the American artist, the African American artists have really inspired them to use hip hop as the way to communicate this to each other.
Right.
When you wrote, when you were writing in the Times today, and let's take a little piece and play some of it under us, because this is was really interesting to me, what came out of Senegal.
Oh yeah, that was fascinating.
Let me see if I say this right, Siddhartha. This is Kourgny Crew, the Kourgny Crew.
Yes.
And so, talk a bit about what's going on in Senegal before we play a little bit of this under us as we speak.
Yeah, so what has happened in Senegal is very interesting, and in the article I sort of parallel it to Tunisia, where we've seen similar things happening, which is just, you know, young people who were involved in this movement of hip-hop and also quite fed up with the status quo of politics, with corruption, with nepotism, mm-hmm. with unemployment, blackouts, just the hardship of everyday life and poverty, and found in hip-hop a means to speak out about it and to write music about it. And so what we saw was at the beginning of the year when there were around March, when, you know, there was this President Wade, the current president, was having these big inauguration or these big commemoration ceremonies to celebrate his 10 years in office, and people just thought it was a farce because of all of the corruption and all of the nepotism and everything going on while, you know, that they were living in conditions of poverty. And so artists like Thiat, who I refer to in the article, he and the Kyogu crew began to speak out about these issues and write songs. And the song that he wrote, the one that is referred to as Rant, the meaning in French, really had an impact and started to mobilize young people. That and other songs that other Senegalese crews were writing as well. And around June, when the very large protest happened in Senegal, you know, trying to oust President Wade and raising a lot of political concerns, these rappers were really at the forefront of that, and they formed a political movement that, you know, really got young people involved to say, you know, we need to pay attention to what's happening in our society. We need to get people to vote. The elections are going to be held later in February. And this organization, Yeye Namara, or We're Fed Up, pretty much is the name of the organization, really wanted to mobilize people to get involved and to do something. And this is what happened was, you know, large numbers of young people began listening to these rappers, began listening to the lyrics and really paying attention and becoming involved. And to me, it speaks to the power of rap to be able to do this.
And what really was interesting to me as I was looking at this, a few weeks ago, there was an article about Youssou N'Dour, who you mentioned in your article, who was going to run for president. Wasn't allowed to. But that in the article, it talked about how the younger generation doesn't listen to his traditional music that's a mixture of Western and traditional music of Senegal, but listens to rap instead, and they find him almost like too old for them, that his politics aren't theirs.
Well, that's kind of indicative of culturally around the world, you know. It's like hip-hop, rock and roll, the blues was always on the edge for the young folks. The young folks use their music of that time period. Now, the time period now, it's hip-hop. Hip-hop is the language of the young and the protest music of the young. Before, you know, at one time it was rock and roll. Don't listen to the African-American music. You know, turn that stuff off. They're telling you the wrong message. They're giving you the wrong thing.
Right.
For me, it was also the beginning of hip-hop when Public Enemy said, fight the power. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you know that one, Sujatha, right? You've got to fight the power. So I think that, what is so interesting about this, though, is that it seems to have such long legs and such incredible political influence, the hip-hop, especially in Senegal. And I was reading about this one, El General, you know. Could you tell us a little bit more about that? Or maybe you could even listen to El General.
We actually have to take a break.
Oh. Well, how about after
and then,
the break?
And then we'll come back.
We'll come back to El General.
We'll do that and hear what Sujatha has to say about you, what you were talking about. We were talking about earlier with this break between the old and the young and what that means musically and politically. And hear a little of the Kugne Kruking Coup de Gunal, and then hear El General and continue our conversation. So don't go away. We'll be right back, Leah and I will, with Sujatha Fernandez.
There you go.
Takal suku takal, unak mangnya ipiar takol. Fak nu takal suku takal, unak mangnya ipiar takol. Fak nu takal suku takal, unak mangnya ipiar takol. Fak nu takal suku takal.
Nana tumaye wo Senegal jai, mugi fakale segle gelah jai. Mugi mai dugal woi, kumai dugal dugal, mai yuki pas.
Welcome back.
Right.
We are here with Sujatha Fernandez, Mark Steiner, and Leah Gilmore, our culture correspondent who joins us here once a month. Always great to have her in the studio. We're trying to get here more.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
And we're talking to Sujatha Fernandez, who is author of a new book, which we'll be talking about next time she joins us, Close to the Edge in Search of the Global Hip-Hop Generation. She's Associate Professor of Sociology, Queens College, and the Graduate Center, City University of New York. Hails from Australia, where she was a hip-hop artist, political activist.
I am so looking forward to reading her book.
Me too.
Yes.
Me too.
Sujatha.
So why don't we pick up where you left off?
Yes, I left off talking about El General. Even before that. Yeah. It seems like in these countries, with African-American hip-hop, there was definitely protest. But we did not experience the same type of intense, polarized violence that has been experienced in a lot of these countries during the Arab Springs and during Senegal and during the civil wars, and how hip-hop has even been more influential. And it has become dangerous, I'm sure, in some places to be a hip-hop artist. Have you seen that, where it has actually put people in danger to perform these songs?
Oh, yeah, and this is what happened to both Siat and El General, who were both put into prison for their music. And with El General, this was sort of happening at the height of the Tunisian protest, and he was arrested on January 6th of last year, and nobody knew what was happening, and there was this video that was made and uploaded to YouTube saying precisely that, you know, that he's in jail, nobody has any information about him. And all of a sudden it was like Al Jazeera did a report about his music, and people started putting messages on Facebook, and it was through YouTube and Twitter, and it started spreading through, you know, to other countries as well, to Libya and to Algeria and Egypt and across to other countries. And within 3 days he was released, and his music had become so much more well known for this being in prison and having his music censored and him being arrested. But you're right. I mean, I think that the kind of situation many of these people are facing is because the realities that they're talking about are realities that are just not being addressed in any other way, because people are too scared to speak about them, or you know, it's dangerous to talk about these things. And rap is this kind of form where you say things very directly. There's no
beating around
the bush,
right,
you know?
Exactly. Exactly.
They, might use metaphor, or they might, you know, use similes and other literary devices, but nevertheless, they're saying things how they are, and people recognize them.
Right, and they're saying things in their language. I think that's what's interesting. Even when I was in France and I was listening to a French rapper, half of his rap was in his tribal, for lack of a better term, language. You know, so they're communicating to each other.
Yes.
Very closely, and I think that's amazing. It's wonderful. You can definitely hear the African American rhythms and the influences, but they have taken this and made it their own. There's something I found really interesting that you said, that about the Arab usage, Arab world, and the rap music. That Arabic has almost become the lingua franca for hip hop now. Could you explain that a bit more?
Well, I guess I just meant that in the sense of how Arabic is, you know, is spoken throughout the Arab world, and so this has provided a very easy means for music to spread. So that people from Egypt can hear El General, and so many others from Tunisia and Egypt and in Saudi Arabia, and you know, the music can just spread so fast because people speak the same language. I guess like in Latin America, where Spanish is
a little bit
people can really communicate quite quickly, and that those ideas and even anthems for protest just pass so quickly from one to the other. And I think, like we saw, you know, these protesters happening one after another in all of these different countries, I think likewise rap music and the messages and the themes were also spreading, and in some ways that the rap lyrics were like the anthems themselves, you know, the chanting. There's just something very similar going on here, and I think people recognize that, and this is what gave strength to both the movements and to the music itself and the spread of that music.
Right.
Let's hear a little bit. We were talking about El General.
Tunisia. I led from the head of state.
And let's hear a little bit of what we've been talking about. You can join us here, by the way, at 410-319-8888 and weigh in again, as we did last week, on the power of hip-hop and what it says to you and what it may be saying to the world and how it may be changing the world politically.
هاني اليوم نحكي معاك باسمي واسم الشعب الكل اللي عايش في الاحلام 2011 مازال فما شكون يموت بالجوع حاب يخدم باش يعيش لكن صوته مش مسموع اهبط للشارع وشوف العباد ولا تحوش شوف الحاكم بالمتراك طاقاتك ما على بالوش مادام ما فما حد باش يقول له كلمه لا حتى القانون اللي في الدستور نفخه وشرب ماه كل نهار نسمع قضيه ركبوها له بالسيف فرطان حاكم يعرف اللي هو عبد نظيف نشوف فلاحلاش تهرب في نسال ما تحاش بيه زعما ترضى هالبنتك عارف كلامي بك العين عارف ما دارك بو ما ترضاش الشر لصغارك الور هذا ميساج عباره واحد من صغارك يحكي معاك من الصفرانس انا عايشين كلك لا باش ترى الشعب عايشين الذل وذاقوا من كاس عذاب رئيس البلاد شعبك مات وشعب من الزبله ثلاثه هاكا تشوف اش قاعد صاير في البلاد مآسي باردو وناس ما قادش فيه.
Oh, yeah.
So Jotha, as I listen to that, one of the things that strikes me is just the, because of where the rhythm and beat of hip hop came from,
right,
the streets
in
from,
New York City,
in the Bronx,
where
it comes from, that the power and rhythm of dislocation, of anger, of wanting something different, it's fueled by the beat, and you can see how why hip hop has grabbed hold of young people across the planet. Whose societies and streets are fighting for change.
And it goes all the way back to the drum.
Right.
You know, you feel that constant rhythm going on.
Right.
Yeah.
And people would say that to me. I mean, I worked in Venezuela with gangster rappers in Venezuela. Yeah. There they would say to me, we don't understand anything of the American rap that we're listening right. to. We don't speak English, but right. it's the rhythm. There's just something.
It's the rhythm, right. right, right.
About the rhythm, and, right. and this is what really, you know, appeals to us. And we're talking about Afro-descendant populations in places like Cuba, Venezuela, many parts of Latin America, and, you know, people who are involved with drumming traditions and, like I mentioned in the article, the griot in West Africa, that there are all of these African diaspora connections as well that that resonate. And so even though the language in some cases may be a barrier, there is still these musical and rhythmic connections that that really resonate very strongly.
That is such a great point. There is definitely a diaspora connection to it, because I was talking to Mark and I said, you know, when I traveled, I've been in France and I've listened. There was points where I would just look at MTV because that was the only English that was on. And I'd listen to all these videos and there would be so many French, you know, African French videos. And I'm telling, it felt like I was home, like I knew it. I didn't know the language, but I felt the rhythm, the right. beat, the timing. It was purely African-American because our music is on the downbeat. It's quite different than Eurocentric music. And this is music that is definitely diasporized. I was listening to some of the lyrics. I mean, that's definitely translated from what we just heard. And he said a lot of money was pledged for projects and infrastructure, schools, hospitals, buildings, houses. But the sons of dogs swallowed it in their big bellies. Now, I know after he said that, there was nothing left to do but go to jail.
Right.
right. Okay.
So, okay. We have on the phones here 410-319-8888. I want to get folks to join us for this conversation. And when we come back, I want to talk to Sujatha about something she wrote months back about Cuba. Oh, we just lost our caller? Okay, our callers, when we come back, 410-319-8888. We'll get you all back when you call back. Sujatha, you talked about Cuba. Cuba has a very intense hip-hop scene.
Hmm. Yes. I bet yes. they would.
Mm-hmm. And it's when I did my research there, and I lived there in the late 90s to about 2001, 2002, and that was in some ways the height of the movement because there were hundreds of rap groups throughout the country, and it was becoming a very important movement because, again, speaking about something that was not otherwise being spoken about, which was the issue of race in Cuba. After the 1959 revolution, there really wasn't much discussion of race. It was assumed that racism was resolved and that there were no more problems, and it was just kind of shut down as an area of discussion. And it really took these young people seeing, you know, the reality of a tourist economy and so many other things that were really exacerbating racism to start speaking about it through the music. And this is how they became such a strong political force within the country that really, you know, made the government listen to them and make changes and respond. And since then, I think, you know, many of the Cuban rappers have emigrated to other countries. There's many living in the UK and in the United States and in Europe. And so what you have now is a much more sort of diasporic Cuban rap scene, and even though in the country there are still some very important groups doing work there, it's not quite the same as it was 10 years earlier.
That's interesting. Is it because there was a political crackdown on the hip-hop artists in Cuba? Is that why that happened?
You know, there was never actually a political crackdown.
Yeah.
I would say it was more, I think what some people have said is that, well, the government sort of came in and they supported the movement, which was actually very good up to a certain point while the rappers were still able to maintain control over their resources and leadership over their movement. And I think at some point they realized that, particularly when the government created a Cuban rap agency and there began to be divisions and then people began to realize that, you know, they may not have as much control. And then others just wanting to experience other things because of the embargo and because of the various other reasons it was very difficult for Cuban rappers to travel overseas. And so many will say, well, we didn't leave for political reasons. We just left because, you know, we needed the space to be able to do our work, and we couldn't do that in Cuba. So a variety of reasons that did include state co-optation, but did mean that there was more of a dispersal of the movement.
So what about how you think with a convergence of the movement of protest politically around the world, the political movement, the almost revolutionary movement around the world, and the culture of hip-hop, how do you think that is transforming the nature of political change and political revolution? What is it doing to it? How is it changing it for the 21st century, do you think?
Well, I would hope, and I don't know if this is, you know, will turn out to be the case, but I would hope what it means is that young people are being listened to a lot more in the change that's going on. I think that, you know, historically within political movements, there's been a sense of, you know, the importance of the elders, which I think still is there, and, you know, of young people, you know, following more than necessarily always leading. And I think what we're seeing here is that, particularly because in many of these countries in the Arab world and in African countries, you have such large youth populations, which is also something unprecedented historically, is that these young people are asserting themselves as a political force, and rap music is one of the ways. I think there are also other ways, maybe other musics, and social media is definitely one way that's connected to rap through which young people are asserting themselves and having a voice. But I think, you know, I would hope that what we're seeing is a way that young people can organize themselves and voice themselves and voice their frustrations and actually play some kind of role in changes as they are unfolding.
So Sujatha, just as I was sitting here thinking about movements, it seems that all political, you know, social movements has a soundtrack, you know, and maybe hip hop is the soundtrack for this particular, you know, the Arab Spring, or part of the soundtrack, if not the entire thing. But it seems to be on a continuum. You know, the civil rights movement had its soundtrack. You know, there was a soundtrack during when Gandhi was working for freedom in India, which you are Indian, right?
Yes, I am.
That's right. So there you go. So as a person of color, you understand that, you know, the music has always been never disassociated when movements were created.
Right. Absolutely. And you know, people have been saying this for some time. I remember when the Paris riots happened, people were saying, well, you know, music is a soundtrack to the rap music is the soundtrack to the Paris riots. Remember when the LA riots happened, people were saying, you know, hip hop is the music for the LA riots. And it seems that it's really seems to be a late 20th century, new millennium kind of thing that
right.
that rap music has come to the forefront, and as at the same time as it's been the most commodified aspect of hip hop culture, it has also had this role of being able to voice and articulate a political stance and a political position.
Right. And all music gets commodified because, you know, even when we had the blues where there was protests about racism from some of the older blues singers in the 20s and 30s, you had, you know, let's rock around the clock, go to the juke joint and have fun. But it's the same music.
Right.
So it's how you choose to use that music to bring your message forth.
Yes.
I think that's important.
Yes.
Did you get the opportunity to, in your book, to interview a lot of these rappers? And who did you find to be the most compelling, some of the most compelling?
Well, yeah, the book kind of details my experiences in some ways living in these countries and just getting involved with the hip-hop scenes and getting to know people. I did some interviews, others I just sort of came to know over a long period of time and learn about them. And I think most inspiring to me, maybe it's as a woman, with some of the female MCs that I met.
Yeah.
One of these being a duo, Mahi and Alexei in Cuba, called Obsesión. And
Obsesión.
And just seeing their evolution from her as this young woman who I met, as a very shy young woman who just rapped in her bedroom and didn't want to, you know, stand up in front of an audience, to rising to the position of the head of the Cuban Rap Agency when it was formed. And really exerting such a powerful influence, both through her music and through her politics, and rapping from things like issues about prostitution and sex work to, you know, to race, to love, to just a broad range of themes. And there was also a rapper in Chicago, Ange 13, that I met, who just, you know, was very inspiring, talking about her own personal experiences growing up, you know, as a young African American woman in Chicago, and I feel like the women, to some extent, have stayed with me because I
understand.
I understand. And I don't talk as much about that in the article because, you know, I haven't come across as many women, and there are many, and especially in Senegal, there are there's a very powerful movement of women musicians and artists there. But I think this is something perhaps that we need to talk more about in global hip hop.
So one of the things that we're looking forward to really is getting your book and having you back on the air.
Oh, yeah.
And playing some of the sounds from around the world.
I'm looking forward to meeting you.
Okay. Me too.
Definitely.
And it's been a real joy to have you with us here.
Thank you so much for having me on. I've really enjoyed being on as well.
And as soon as your publisher gets the book to us, we'll get right back and have you back on.
That sounds
there
great.
You there you go.
Sujatha Fernandez, her book is Close to the Edge, In Search of the Global Hip-Hop Generation. She's Associate Professor of Sociology, Queens College, and Graduate City Center, University of New York. And it's part of our continuing conversation about the power of hip-hop across the country, across the globe, across Baltimore, where this radio station and our radio show comes from. And Sujatha,
and we still have very powerful African-American political hip-hop artists.
Yes, and they've been...
Yes.
Sujatha, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
What we didn't do is we didn't go to Deeb.
Oh.
We come a little deep under us as we kind of
time?
Walk. We have time to talk, have a little deep play beneath us as we kind of wrap up this part
up.
Of our program.
Mm-hmm.
Because I want to encourage folks, as Leah Gilmore is sitting here with me, to not go away after this brief break we're going to take in a couple minutes, because we're going to come back with the cast of Gleam.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to see it on Sunday.
Based on Zora Neale Hurston's work.
Right. Their eyes were watching God.
An amazing play. These three actors are just amazing. They have consumed Zora Neale Hurston, and it'll be a wonderful conversation coming up the next half an hour for you all. And I want to remind people as we go out of here, at least until we get back to our folks from Center Stage, is that WEAA invites you to our Zimbabwe Shona Stone exhibition here at our studios. It runs through the end of February. The exhibition is courtesy of the Zimbabwe Gallery, Colin L. Thompson, the owner. The exhibition is open to the public weekdays from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Evening appointments are available. More information, 443-885-3564, or go to weaa.org, and it's a beautiful sculpture work.
It's a beautiful. Amazing. And I'll see you Friday.
Why?
Because I have a concert coming up Friday here in Baltimore, not in Siberia. Okay? You don't have to get an airplane.
Where?
It's at the Brown Memorial Woodbrook Presbyterian Church.
At?
At 8 p.m. Doors 8. Open at 7:30. You better hurry up and get your tickets. You have to go to commongroundonthehill.org or 410-857-2771.
And I will be there Friday night with Leah and introducing Leah this evening.
Yeah, saying nice things.
What else would I say, girl? I'm not going to say nice things.
I better watch yourself, Mark Steiner.
Leah Gilmore, thanks for joining us once again.
Thank you. You know it's always my pleasure.
Always good to have you. You added so much tonight to the show. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, babe.
All right. Y'all listen to this, and we'll be back with Gleam. So don't go away. حابسين دم الملايين زي التعبين مستعد اغني مع شعبان عبد الرحيم اعمل اغنيه اسمها انا بكره الظالمين وقتي بضحي شعبي بصحي ميكروفون صاحبي بيقدر صراحتي معاه بكون على راحتي الحياه نكته اهلا بيك في مسرحتي وقتي بضحي شعبي بصحي